Taking such an extended break meant canceling concerts, but according to Billie Jean, he seemed unconcerned about getting back to work. Johnny Cash had a habit of doing what he wanted to do, she explains. How did he explain his absence to Vivian? Johnny didn't do any explaining. He knew that I needed him. I really did need him because losing Horton just about killed me. He was determined to put me back on my feet. By the time we left New York, I was doing so much better, and he would call me several times a day to see how I was progressing. Johnny was such a caring person. You really had a friend when you had Johnny Cash. The relationship continued along the lines established when her husband was alive. Cash essentially divided his time off the road between Encino and Shreveport. He saw to Billie Jean's finances and arranged for a portion of his royalties to be paid into her account to tide her over until she received the royalties from Horton's final hit, North to Alaska. He also protected her privacy. If anyone wanted access to Billie Jean Horton now, they knew that they had to go through Johnny Cash. More than 40 years later, Billie Jean remains discreet about the precise nature of the relationship. She starts by describing it as the obligation of someone who had promised to care for her in the event of her husband's death. Then she describes him as my brother in spirit. Finally, she admits to a love she believes would have developed further had it not been for his escalating drug consumption. In the weeks before his death, Horton was trying to help Cash go straight. I loved Johnny, she says. I loved him for all his life. We were so close, but the only thing that put the kibosh on it was the drugs. Had he not been on the pills, trust me, I would have married him because I cared that much about him, and I knew that he loved me. I had to hold back because I didn't know how to handle anyone on drugs or booze because Horton was so clean. Another obstacle to any long-term relationship was Billie Jean's desire to pursue her own singing career. Cash wanted her waiting at home for him in Shreveport. Cash did not like me on the road, she says. He liked me to stay at home, with him coming back and forth. That was his idea, and if I'd have done that, would probably have led to marriage. Her refusal to be tamed led to some explosive outbursts. Once, while both performing in Vancouver on the same night, she was part of the showcase at the Queen Elizabeth Theater, while he and the Tennessee Two were playing at the Cave. They stayed at the Hotel Georgia, and after an argument, Cash stormed down the hallway, smashing the hotel's antique chandeliers. Not only did he have to pay for all the damage, but he and his entourage had to check out immediately. So you gave up all between us for a glamorous career, and with all your talent, you should be the big star of the year. Then you'll be public property, so I release my claim to you. Go on and give them all you've got. Sing it pretty, Sue. I can't take just part of you and give the world a half, so smile for all the papers and give them autographs. Go on to all the cities so your public can see you, but I'll watch on television, so sing it pretty, Sue. Sing it pretty, Sue. 1961. In April 1961, Cash began work on his second gospel album for Columbia. The Tennessee Two had expanded to become the Tennessee Three with the addition of drummer W.S. Fluke Holland in August. Cash's faith had hit an all-time low, and even he noticed the irony in finally having the opportunity to give voice to his religious feelings. He didn't question the validity of his conversion or the basis of his theology, but he had grown spiritually sluggish after so many years away from regular worship, and he knew that his behavior went against everything he had been taught, both by his mother and his church. He had felt challenged the year before when he met Pat Boone at the Steel Pier in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and Cash had been impressed by Boone's clear-eyed and clean-cut appearance that contrasted so markedly with his own hollowed cheeks and dilated pupils. He knew that Boone's freshness reflected the steadfastness of his faith. I was a little ashamed of myself at the time because of the hypocrisy of it all, he said in 1973. There I was singing the praises of the Lord and singing about the beauty and the peace you find in him, and I was stoned and miserable. I was climbing the walls. His first arrest came in November 1961. At 3:30 in the morning, City Police Inspector W.J. Donahoe and two traffic officers stopped Cash and Glenn Douglas Tubb, author of Home of the Blues, outside a club near Nashville's Printer's Alley. Apparently, Johnny was kicking down the door of a club he thought was refusing him entry, only to find that it was in fact closed. Both men spent 4 hours in jail, and after paying a $5 bond, were released. On the police blotter, Johnny Cash listed himself as an actor. The next day's story in the Nashville Banner was headlined, "Johnny Cash Arrested Here on Drunk Charge." By late 1961, Canadian Saul Holliffe, who had started out in the clothing and restaurant businesses, had taken over the managing of Cash's career. In 1959, Bob Neal sold his 50% share in Cash's management to Stu Carnall, who acted as his sole manager until July 1961, when Cash realized that no one was managing Johnny Cash Enterprises when he was on tour. The things that had made Carnall a charming sophisticate, his love of gambling, good food, fast cars, and fine wine, made him an inefficient manager. "I think things changed for Johnny Cash," says Lori Collins Carnall. "He was having a lot of problems. I'm sure that some of it was Stu's fault, too. He loved to party and have a good time. He was a player at the horses. In fact, he talked Johnny into buying a horse that they named Walk the Line, but that's just about all this horse did. He walked. He didn't run." The end for Carnall came when Cash embarked on a Canadian tour promoted by Saul Holliffe. "Stu was a great playboy and a lot of fun to be around, but he just wasn't taking care of business," says Johnny Western. "We were in Ontario and Johnny had been trying to get him all day on the phone, but Stu was on the racetrack. He had important business to handle and he just wasn't around. When Cash finally got through to him and realized where he'd been, he fired him. Marshall suggested that Saul should take over. He said that he had done more for him on those Canadian dates than Stu had done for him in years. Cash took a good hard look at that before deciding to hire him." A sophisticated Canadian, Holliffe was the antithesis of a country music manager. He wasn't even a country fan, his music of choice being jazz. But he had heard Five Feet High and Rising, Cash's hit song about the 1937 flood at Dyess, on a jukebox and liked it enough to book a few gigs for Johnny Cash in the Tennessee too. "I had promoted people like the Everly Brothers, Paul Anka, and Bill Haley, but I really wasn't familiar with Johnny Cash at all," he admits. "In fact, I wasn't familiar with much of anything in country music. I had to become familiar in a hurry when things played out the way they did." Being an outsider to both the U.S. and to country music affected the way Holliffe managed Cash. He marketed him to a broader, more international audience and took him beyond the narrow confines of the country genre. Holliffe coined the phrase, "America's foremost singing storyteller," to describe Johnny Cash. He first used it in souvenir programs and later in industry advertisements. "He didn't know he was a singing storyteller until I told him," says Holliffe. "I wasn't anxious to play up the country label especially. Labeling was a serious thing. If you were lumped into a certain category, it meant restricted airplay. I thought that singing storyteller was nebulous enough,"